21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Cordner, and our engineer is Jake Bryant. Our guest for the first half of this hour is photographer Elliot Landy, whom we recorded recently about his Woodstock visions. His book is published by Hal Leonard and is available wherever fine books are sold. And you can see some of Elliot's famous photos of Jim Morrison, the band, Janis Joplin, Bob Dylan, and more at www.landyvision.com. Before Woodstock, you had photographed musicians at the opening of Bill Graham's and John Morris's Fillmore East, which was March 8th, I think it was, 1968. How did you get that job?
It really wasn't a job. I did all this work, almost all the work in that book. I did. No one paid me for any of it in advance. And I was working with the underground newspapers. I was taking the pictures, and I would give them for free to the underground newspapers, and they'd pay me for film and processing, like $35 or something. I became the photo editor of a newspaper called The Rat, which is The Rat Subterranean News, underground news. And the reason I became the photo editor was because, number one, there was no one else there. Number two, I always liked to choose and lay out my own pictures. So that let me do that. I didn't have to give it to someone, and then they made a mess of it. And we had left the offices, and the offices were on 6th Street and Second, or just off 2nd Avenue, somewhere downtown off 2nd Avenue. And we walked by the Anderson Theater and the marquee, and the marquee said, Country Joe and the Fish light show tonight. You know, there was a concert going on. And we went inside. I had my camera bag with me, and I was greeted by this incredible light, this incredible wall of sound and light. It was a singular experience. Light shows in those days were quite different than what we do with concerts today. They were very organic, and there was like five people playing with images and colors and oils and slide projectors behind the stage, you know. And so it was really a double concert. You were hearing the music, and you were watching visual musicians play at the same time. And the visual musicians were not coordinated with one another. They weren't choreographed, rather. They each did what they were each doing their own thing, you know. And so together you got an incredible jam band, but it was a visual jam band. So that's what a live light show is about. And to me, it's much more intense than anything I've seen done in concert. But I don't go to that many concerts. I can't really speak like that. I'm sure there's some great stuff being done. But anyway, so I walked in and I saw this, I experienced this incredible moment. And I said, and I don't remember if it was that I took pictures because I wanted to get up close or I wanted to take pictures of it, probably both at the same time. But my cameras allowed me to go right up to the front of the stage and be very near it. And my first picture, one of the first pictures I took, was an image of Country Joe from Country Joe and the Fish, Joe McDonald. And I was able to put it in this version of the book. There's a red background behind him, and he's blue. That was really my first, like, concert photograph. And I was hooked on it, and I went back the next week, and Janis Joplin was playing Big Brother and the Holding Company. This is still the Anderson Theater, which is across the street from what became the Fillmore. And I went back the second week, and I got, I started taking more pictures, and that was kind of the beginning of my commercial career in music photography. And because I was with the underground newspapers, it was easy to get backstage, and they let me backstage because we felt the same way about things. But I didn't engage in conversations with them at the time. As a photographer, I like not to be seen and just kind of do your own thing, and I'll do mine, you know, and let me be what they refer to as a fly on the wall, which you don't notice. Mm-hmm. So the Fillmore was really run by the people. They were doing the concerts at the Anderson, a guy named John Morris, was a stage announcer at Woodstock, a very, very, very fine man, very fine human being. And because I was with these underground newspapers, they let me into the film where they let me photograph it because of the respect for being part of that underground culture. I think they would have let any press in, but the mainstream press wasn't that interested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yet, because there was no money involved, that's why.
Well, that's right. There never was. Yeah. I mean, when I was going to be doing album covers for Elektra Records.
Oh yeah.
And
what, as a photographer?
No, as an artist. Being an artist myself, and they were paying like $100 to $200. Now it would take about for me anywhere from 4 to 6 months to design something.
Really?
You couldn't live.
Wow.
You could not live. On that kind of money, and you weren't ever even guaranteed that you'd get it anyway. So you could do all of that. One of the first that you remember a group called John Fred and his Playboy Band.
I remember the name, yes.
Where they had 1 6-million seller called Judy in Disguise, Okay, so they were recorders for Elektra Records, and they went to the people up New York and said, "We want this guy to do our album cover." And they didn't tell them what they told me, which was, he said to me, "We don't want our photos on the album. We don't even want to have ourselves on the album. We want something that is about consciousness." And I said, "Fine,
I didn't know that. Wow.
I can handle that." Well, of course, then I went up to Elektra and I said, "Well, this is what we're going to do." He said, "No, you're not going to do it." I said, "What do you mean I'm not going to do it?" And he said, "They've had it." He said, "They're not going to, they're not, you know, they had a 6 million hit, and that's about the end of them. So
wow.
What we want you to do," and that's how they said, "Look, why don't you go to these various places and venues, meet the singers, and go backstage with them, and then you figure out who you want to work with." But anyway, I was just commenting on the job, money-wise,
yes.
Which was,
how interesting.
You could get just about anything else, but you weren't going to get money.
For the Bob Dylan National Skyline, I think $300.
Oh.
And there's actually another cosmic moment there, because and I knew it at the time as well, because this was for National Skyline, and I had already become engaged with metaphysical thought at that point. And I was paid for the film, the processing. You know, you put in the bill at the end of the job. And the job happened because Bob called me up and said, "Come on over, I need a picture," period. There was no contracts or anything like that with the record label, thank goodness, because it never would have happened. There were no art directors present. There was no directions from anybody, because Albert Grossman had gotten Bob the freedom to do that. He was, I believe, the first star, the first musician to totally control everything about his work.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there were others before him, I don't know. But Albert really had the record labels under control. So the film, the processing, the fee, everything came to $740. And then, you know, like the number of miles, right, and lunch was $2.10 or whatever it was, and the gas and the tolls and the fee was $300. So it came to $740 total. And then with New York State sales tax, which had to be charged on something like that, it came to $777.
Nice number.
That was the amount, the magic number. You know,
yeah, did you get it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
At the time, I say, I've been aware of it. Yeah, I did. And I said, "That's far out, you know. This is very interesting."
That's a hell of a number.
This is your call. Yeah, but just by chance, again, I'm saying involving the most minuscule things. I still have that, actually, receipt and bill, and I should probably show it. If my shows get more metaphysical, I should do that.
Well, you know, the synchronicity or meaningful coincidences, or what other people think is chance, you know, it's so multi-leveled that who knows exactly why we're asked to do just about anything until you probe into previous lifetimes. Mm. But that's something we can't talk about now. Now, you noted that you were never into personalities of the performers. You mentioned that earlier, who you were photographing. But one of them was Janis Joplin. Would you share that experience that happened in Detroit when you guys were ready to go out somewhere? Remember that?
Actually, that moment, I would almost have to read it from the book now, but I remember it was actually after a concert in New York. I forget which one it was. It might have been from Club Generation or something, because I knew them pretty well at that point. I had what happened was the first time I photographed them was at the Anderson Theater, then at the Fillmore East, and then I got an assignment from New York Magazine to go to Detroit with them. They went to the Grandy Ballroom, and then I got to know them fairly well and was very comfortable with the guys and Janis. And we were coming
going home. It was in New York City, and we were all in a cab, maybe three, four, five of us, I think, and going someplace, and they were going to a party, and Janice was there, and they said, oh, why don't you come with us to the party, you know? And she said, no, man, I'm just not in the mood. I'm so depressed. And she just got out, you know, and she said, I really just want to be with someone. I don't know. And she just got out, and I just remember seeing her walk down, just walk away. She might have been going to a girlfriend's house or something. But the total sadness of her feeling, how she was feeling, the depression, whatever it was that drove her to where she went to in life, was so apparent. And I think I wrote about it probably better than I talk about it now. I find, I watched an interview that I did about Woodstock. I did it in 94 for the 25th anniversary, and I had a videotape of it. And I watched it, and I said so many things I've forgotten totally about already, you know, in the years afterwards. I think once you say them, a lot of them, they leave you, and, mm-hmm. you know, they brings back room for new things. But
you know what,
allows room.
In the book, you noted, and she said, man, what a drag. Here I am,
that's right, yes.
A big star,
thank you.
And I can't find anyone to be with.
That's right, exactly. And I totally forgot.
Well,
that was exactly,
if you think you've forgotten things, though, yeah. I can tell you a few hundred billion things I've forgotten.
Well,
I painted,
you don't forget them. The thing. You don't remember what you forget.
Right, yeah.
Well,
right now we are trying to figure out what happened to the original bus that went up to Woodstock that was in my possession. And I was in the middle of founding an esoteric school and everything else. And I can't remember. And people have asked me, and then I've even had one person say, well, you didn't paint that bus if you can't remember, which is, you know, but, you know, I don't know why. But there were a lot more important things than a painted bus, I can tell you that. Now, you already mentioned Bob Dylan. And how did Dylan try to make it clear to you that a musician's success wasn't necessarily reflected in their personal lives, and they weren't gurus? It's on page 30 of your book.
Yeah,
with that gorgeous, with that gorgeous photo of Country Joe in the background, with the Joshua Light. Was that I don't know if it's a Joshua Light show, because that was.
Oh yeah, that's
Anderson.
The one with the red background that I was talking about, where he's blue. Right, that's the first rock and roll concert I ever went to, and in this book I was able to publish it in the earlier version of it. You know, we couldn't use color everywhere. So in this book, when I relayed out the whole book and I expanded pictures, and I really had it was a very rushed situation. I did nothing else for 2 months because it was a last-minute thing. But I was so glad to be able to finally publish that picture.
It's a powerful picture. I mean, really. It carries, I think, he must have loved it. He must have loved that piece.
I don't know if he's seen it, actually.
Oh, really?
It hasn't gone anywhere. I it's not even on my website. It just kind of got forgotten in some way. But you asked me about Dylan. He was very self-effacing about what he had done. And to me personally, he was very humble about himself, which is very different than the view we had of him from Don't Look Back, where he was this very aggressive, obnoxious, inconsiderate person in that movie, the Pennybaker movie. When I knew him, he was living with his family in the country with four or five children, and was a very loving father and, you know, very nice man, very, very gentle guy. And we had lots of conversations, and I had come from being a political activist, not very activist, but very politically minded, wanting to change the world and make it better and blah, 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 you know. And I was talking about all this, or I started to bring up some political things that were going on. And he said, I'm not really into politics. And I said, what do you mean you're not into politics? You've written these songs as the anthems for the political movement, you know, for the alternative, for the underground movement here, you know, and all these great, great anti-war songs, these anthems. And how can you write these things without being political? And he said to me, he says, I don't know. He says, I just pick up what's in the air. He says, and I put words to it. Just like that, which is, of course, now we understand that it's a psychic experience.
Yeah.
You psychically pick up things, and you know, now in his autobiographies or on TV and so on, I've caught which I haven't seen actually, all of any of them, but I saw that he says, I don't know where those songs came from. I don't know how I wrote them. He says, I didn't write those. He says, I can't do that today, but he was just at that point plugged in. Tuned into another sphere, another dimension, receiving, you could call it channeled, you could call it guidance, you could call it talking to his higher self, talking to his wisdom from other lifetimes. It's hard to really put words to it because they're really only words. It doesn't really explain it. Like, you can't really explain the color green. You can say green and think, you know, we agree with on it, but it's not an explanation for anything.
Well, you we'll get back to Dylan in a second here, but your big break came, at least noted in this book on page 84, that when Albert Grossman, who managed Joplin, Dylan, and a lot of other folks, asked you to photograph the band and their new album, Music from Big Pink. How did this come about?
Well, there's a story in the book that goes on extensively, but I won't get into too much here unless you want me to. But Albert, the first concert I photographed in New York City was the Woody Guthrie Memorial Concert in late 67, early 68, where it was the first time Dylan was playing live in about a year and a half. People had thought he died in a motorcycle accident because he had a motorcycle accident, was incapacitated for a while, and no one saw him publicly. He'd never been photographed. And suddenly there was a memorial concert to Woody Guthrie, and Dylan was playing. So I called up. And I don't know, do you want me to go into that story?
Sure. Look, if you got the time, we got the time.
Oh, yeah.
It makes no difference because
we
are finally getting – you are one of the few – this is embarrassing for you, and I am sorry if I am embarrassing you, but you are one of the few of all the photographers that I've met and worked with over the past 40-some years that really has a comprehension of the inner workings of this. There's no one that I have – spent time with or even have read about that pokes below the surface because they do not have that spiritual dimension, which they don't necessarily think is important, and yet it probably is key to most of the things that any artist, whether they're a writer, a painter, a poet, or anyone who gets involved with the act of creation, and that kundalini force comes up within the body. You spend 8-10 hours in one room focused on one thing, you will transform yourself. Now, you understand that perfectly, but most other individuals in this area will think that that is a bunch of crap.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
That's why this is such a privilege, and I am sorry again for if I embarrass you by saying things that may seem too highfalutin, because to me they're not.
No,
these are basic.
I'll tell you what I accept what you say, and I say thank you, and I'm actually pleased to hear it because I'm 66 years old and have kind of thought that all this stuff, let's call it, was really important and the key to life for many years, and lived it and acted it. And for a lot of times, I haven't had a lot of money. I don't have a lot of money now, but I was even asking for money on the street at some point when we were in Denmark, because I believe in everything we're talking about here, everything you're saying. But a defining lesson for me in life, you know, so I can say yes, thank you, and I'm sorry that there aren't more people who feel the same way that you and I do about this and have the same insights. But I guess that's why we're going to be on the air talking about it, is to share that. But what I realize that it doesn't make me better than anybody else, just makes me different. When I was in Denmark, after the 60s, I wanted to find a pure place in the world to live, and this we're not going to go into too much on this show, but I had a young child, a year old, and my wife and a 70-pound dog, and we didn't want to live in the States anymore because Nixon was president, the Vietnam War was being supported by this culture, advertising was taking over, and I saw the way the American life and culture was going. And we wanted to find a pure place in the world to live, a better place to bring up our child, a better place for us to live. In a naive sense, we wanted to do that. So we decided to leave the States and go to Europe to start with. And I wound up leaving with only $22 when we landed in Amsterdam with a dog and a baby and so on. But I'm not going to talk about that story, because that's another trip. during that time period, we had, at times, no money whatsoever. I mean, zero.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that, we started making candles. Candles was art. And we were trading and selling candles. And I was trading with the butcher for dog food, you know. This is in Copenhagen. And I was trading with the camera store guy sometimes, and I had money from some of it. But I realized, and I kind of understood what I did. I liked my work in the 60s, you know, with the rock and roll, the music work, and the peace demonstration stuff. And then I was decided I only wanted to show what was innocent and pure, which became for me my child and my wife, you know, their relationship, mother child and baby photographs, for the innocence of it, the beauty, the purity of it. That's what I said, this is what I want to put out there in the world. This is what I want to share. Because it's what I was experiencing. It wasn't like I went out and I'm going to find it. It was right there in my life, and I said, well, this is what I'm going to photograph. But I realized that I couldn't do any of this stuff, and I had a very high opinion of the work artistically. I said, this is really important work, and it's really important that people see this stuff, and I really have something to offer people that's different than what other people are offering in the art form. But I realized that I couldn't do any of it without the man that spent his whole life behind the counter in the photography store, or the guy who worked at Kodak. I once picked up a blind man who was hitchhiking. This was in the early 80s. And he was blind, and he was hitchhiking with his white and red stick, and he was on the New York State Thruway. And he told me that he was going up, and he was hitchhiking blind. It's quite an amazing thing. He was going up to work for Polaroid in Massachusetts, because they used blind people in the darkroom because they knew their way around, you know. They were used to it. But I had realized that I couldn't do anything without people that do all this, what we think of as mundane work, you know, the clerk in the store and the butcher and the guy that started the store and the whole thing. And that was one of the moments of revelation for me, was that just because I may be doing work that people think is great, that I think is terrific, that's very special, unique, beautiful, that may last, doesn't make me any better mm-hmm. than somebody else. It just makes me part of the game that we're all part of. Yeah. Part of the, I guess game is not really, but it's kind of a game.
Life can be looked at that way, yeah, sure. Well, we will play the second half of our extensive interview with celebrity photographer Elliot Landy on a future show, because right now we have a very special guest coming up for the remainder of tonight's program. After you finish looking at the photos at LandyVision.com, jump on over to JimiHendrix.com and you'll find all kinds of exciting things, like the film we're going to focus on with his sister, Janie Hendrix, coming up next on 21st Century Radio, so don't go away.
WCBM.
Gene Leitner of Maryland's Golden Radio Buffs returns for a summer special of old-time radio, so warm up the old Philco and tune in for one of my all-time favorite shows. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Would you like to win a free copy of the book we were talking about? Woodstock Vision, The Spirit of a Generation by Elliot Landy. Backbeat Books, www.backbeatbooks.com or landyvision.com. Now, if you know the answer to this hour's trivia question, you will win that book, plus other books and magazine, over a dozen altogether. And the question is this: do you know the name of our first hour guest on 21st Century Radio last week? All you got to do is tell us the name of our first guest on 21st Century Radio last week, and you're going to be our winner, but you need to qualify. Here's how you do it. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
Hello there. This is George Martin, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
When Jimi Hendrix first came back from England, he fell in love with Woodstock, and he was looking for a place to live and to practice and to play music.
Woodstock had always been known from the early 20s as a hotbed for artistic endeavors. There were painters and sculptors, writers, and then later on in the 50s and 60s, entertainers who loved that peace and tranquility of Woodstock as a place to go to recharge their batteries.
It was the place to come to. It was not just a rock and roll show. It was not just about the music. It was really about that decade and that culture.
Well, that actually, you know, that was Michael Lang saying Woodstock was more about a decade and the decade and the culture than the music. And that's at that particular point, that's when the Woodstock bus, the bus that I painted that went up to Woodstock, was being shown. And actually, it was talking about the philosophy of Woodstock. Now, if you ask those who attended Woodstock in 1969, who the key musician was, the person they thought ranked at the top of all the performances, the majority, the vast majority would say Jimi Hendrix. Mike Lang, one of the four co-producers of Woodstock, chose Hendrix as a must-have performer. And that's why he was paid more than all the other musicians and was given his choice as to when to come on. He chose to be the closer of the event, and that was against the wishes of Mike Lang, but he did it anyway. And one of the holiday gifts I requested in 2008 was Jimi Hendrix, Live at Woodstock, the definitive 2-DVD collection, and it is the definitive record of one of Jimmy's most celebrated performances. Now, I've watched it over a dozen times, and each time I've discovered something new. The first time I reviewed it, I literally fell out of my chair because within the first minute, there was the bus that I painted that went up there, and I had no idea it was being filmed at that time period. And, of course, the owner of that was Robert Grimm, who's joined us before. He took it up to Woodstock, and it filled the screen for a few seconds. Yes, the same bus that Rolling Stone, Associated Press, Life magazine, and others featured scores and scores of times around the planet that I never saw until 10 years later, became, in the words of Mike Lang, a symbol for the meaning of the Woodstock experience. Now, joining us again to discuss this definitive 2-DVD set, Jimi Hendrix Live at Woodstock, is one of its co-producers, Janie Hendrix, Jimmy's sister, who heads the family companies of Experience Hendrix and Authentic Hendrix. And also, she is the chief executive officer and the president. The DVD's second producer is legendary John McDermott, who has served as catalog manager for Experience Hendrix since 1995 and the author of two books on Jimi Hendrix. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Janie, and thank you for joining us live during what must be an exciting time for you during this 40th anniversary of Woodstock.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we embark on what Jimmy accomplished at Woodstock 1969, let's take a look at the 2-DVD set of Jimi Hendrix Live at Woodstock, which comes with a multitude of special bonus features. It begins with The Road to Woodstock, during which Mike Lang tells us why Hendrix was the key to attracting all the other rock royalty to Woodstock. What would you like to say about that particular segment?
You know, it was really a labor of love to do the DVD and the CD, especially the DVD. It took us about a year to put that together. It
I'm amazed at all the different things that they had, especially within this particular DV in this first segment. Which, of course, Mike Lang and Hendrix Band and Mitch Mitchell, Billy Cox, Larry Lee, Juma, do you pronounce it Juma, Juma Sultan?
We pronounce it Juma at the
Juma.
Time.
Juma, okay, Juma Sultan.
And to do all the interviews and to meet everyone, and sadly, of course, we don't have Mitch or Larry anymore, but they were wonderful. When they were alive, they came to the various studios that we were at to do the interviews. To do the color corrections, that was painstakingly work, but it was a labor of love.
Was something that is really, well, Jimi Hendrix Live at Woodstock also has another DVD, the second one, called A Second Look. What does this particular DVD, what does it contain?
We have some black and white footage that was shot by actually a young kid that both Warner Brothers and the people in Michael Lang's camp, they thought that he was working for one and the other. So he was able to just, like, be there and, you know, talk about being at the right place at the right time. He definitely was.
You know, I didn't even know that videotape existed in 1969. And just as he said, you know, he wanted to get to Woodstock, couldn't get there until the last day.
Yes.
Then when he got there, he had someone run interference. Actually, he was his friend was he carrying a guitar or something? His friend was carrying a guitar and he hid behind him.
Yeah, right. That's exactly what happened.
And then he set it up on the stage, and I was thinking to myself, how in the world? I mean, that takes a lot of guts. I think his name was Albert Goodman. Albert Goodman, boy. And that second look DVD of uninterrupted footage features something, a performance I'd always want to hear called Hear My Train A-Comin'. Boy, that was the first time that was ever presented?
It is the first time that was ever presented there, and then, of course, the documentary that had it. Hold on one second. My children are coming in to be part of the interview, I guess.
Oh, okay. Well, that's okay. They can join us.
I have
us.
A little bit of distraction today. Yes, that was definitely the first time that it was presented, and what a marvelous and wonderful performance it was.
Oh, yeah. Now, Hendrix, then, of course, the third aspect of the Jimi Hendrix press conference. This was September 3rd, 1969. This was about 2 weeks after Woodstock. He speaks about the festival. Can you recall what he said at that particular time as to what he felt about that rendition of the Star Spangled Banner?
He really thought it was beautiful. He thought it was a tribute that he was giving back to America after being 101st Airborne and serving for his country. And giving people back the sounds that were going on in the war and sounds that he heard from being in the Army and jumping out of planes. Of course, he wasn't in the war, but he really did feel for the people that were over there and felt that it was really a senseless war. Yeah. And his rendition was to give to the people what he felt in his heart from his guitar playing.
Well, that we talked a little earlier, you noted that that wasn't the first time that he did the Star Spangled Banner.
No, it wasn't. He actually he did perform it in Seattle the year, well, probably about a little bit less than a year before, and kind of practiced it on the audience. I think I told you before where my father was really thinking that the police were going to come and arrest him. He kept looking at the police going, I should be doing that, but he did. He did it, and no, he didn't get arrested. And, you know, as he said on the Dick Cavett show, that he really did think it was a beautiful tribute.
But then there was a segment on Nashville Roots, and thanks to you, Billy Cox will be joining us in the week or so to come. He is the last remaining of all of the bands that Hendrix played with, is he not?
He is, well, Juma is still alive, but actually, yes, of the
original
mainstays, yes, the original. And of course, he'll tell you, he'll be glad to tell you the stories that they played together back in Army times, because they were First Airborne together.
Mm-hmm. Well, then another segment with engineer Eddie Kramer, who details the entire epic festival. And then there's that segment on rare artifacts and memorabilia, the Woodstock poster, the festival tickets, Hendrix's own handwritten set list, and a poem about the festival, 500,000 Halos. I really enjoyed those. Now, the greatest of all those who create music, books, films, dance, etc., is that they grow and that they evolve. They experiment. They take chances. They gamble that their audience, fans, and management will support those changes. And in 1969, Jimi Hendrix decided he wanted to make some kind of changes. What kind of changes did he want to make?
Well, he wanted to bring the people a new sound. He wanted to bring people, you know, he's really excited. I remember when he came back home, he said to my dad, "You're going to be doubly proud of me because I want to make a new sound." And he really wanted to bring in other instruments, make a big band sound, and expand his three pieces to multi-pieces to bring in horns and keyboards and just give people a larger experience hearing a more vast amount of musicians on stage, which is what he did with Gypsy Sons and Rainbows.
So just weeks before the historic event, he was creating a new sound, a new band, at a rented house, I believe, up near Woodstock. Who were some of the members of this new group and the kind of instruments they played?
Well, they had the congos, and they had, of course, another guitar. Larry Lee was playing the other guitar. And also, you know, he had other people that he was playing with, not necessarily on stage, but like Stephen Stills and Taj Mahal and different people. They were just jamming. And so this was kind of what he was trying to bring, kind of adding another genre of a little bit of jazz. And
he had great admiration for jazz, didn't he?
He really did, you know, and you can hear all the different genres in his music and, of course, his own, which is what we call the Hendrix sound,
yeah,
which I don't think anyone can duplicate or has since his passing.
Well, I know others have tried, but I don't think they can come near it. You know, if Jimmy was the kind of guy that he slept with his guitar. From the time he went to bed to the time he got up, he was playing all the time. And you do that for decades, and friends, you know, you just live with it, you know. It becomes you. Now, as you noted, the name of the new group was Gypsy Sons and Rainbows, which later evolved into a three-piece group called Band of Gypsies. The Band of Gypsies, when they grew into the Band of Gypsies, there were just three then. He returned back to three. Is that right?
Well, for the Band of Gypsies, yes. It was Buddy Miles, Billy Cox, and Jimmy. And, of course, the Band of Gypsies, as we knew it then, was to satisfy a contract that he had signed as well. So he reduced it to that to be able to perform, of course, on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day to satisfy a contract that he had signed back in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take our break now in this hour. When we return, I've always wanted to talk to someone about Jimi Hendrix's fashion trend. He was a trendsetter, no doubt about that. And his dress, his clothing at this particular event was just gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. Would you mind sharing us some information about that when we return, dear?
Oh, I'd love to, Bob. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, we'll be back with our guest, Janie Hendrix, sister of Jimi Hendrix and the producer of the film Jimi Hendrix, live at Woodstock, jimihendrix.com. You got to get a copy of this DVD.
Talk, you ought to know. Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
If you're a business owner or executive seeking growth yet determined to cut wasteful costs, consider outsourcing your whole marketing department to The Selling Well. The Selling Well offers businesses truly superior marketing services without all the overhead costs associated with employing a full-time marketing executive. Learn more online at thesellingwell.com. That's thesellingwell.com, named after one of our greatest symbols of prosperity, the well. Visit thesellingwell.com or call The Selling Well's managing partner, Plato Hieronymus, at 443-939-1890. TheSellingWell.com.
Hi, this is Raymond Eric of The Doors, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
This was like military warfare. I mean, you know, helicopters coming in, dropping out. We didn't get a chance to get a helicopter. It just took forever to get there.
Remember, we all loaded up in some old station wagons. the whole band and whoever was going, and was heading for the helipad. And we finally got there, and the helicopter wasn't running, so we had to go on in the station wagon. It had rained, and as we pulled up out there, I saw people laying out there. I thought they were dead, man, covered with mud. Got in there, naked people, you know. I had never seen that, you know. I figured I'd been gone too long in Vietnam.
Yeah, that was a few segments from Jimi Hendrix Live at Woodstock. Let's see, that was Larry Lee. Was that not Larry Lee, Janie?
Yes, that was Larry.
Yeah, Larry Lee. Oh, I really enjoyed that particular segment when he and Billy Cox sat down and unwound the story of the time of Nashville and all the different aspects of their the fabled R&B Chitlin circuit. That was quite an pretty exciting time period. Janie, by the way, I forgot to introduce Janie Hendrix, sister of Jimi Hendrix and producer of the film Jimi Hendrix Live at Woodstock, jimihendrix.com. Now, by the way, again, this is a 2-DVD set. There's stuff in here you're not going to get or see anywhere else. One of the things that I've always loved about Jimmy was his dress. There's no doubt about it, he was a fashion trendsetter. And for this particular event, he wore a very special outfit. Could you describe this outfit?
Well, he had on the white suede jacket with the turquoise colored beads. And it was really reminiscent of the Cherokee Indian side, where my grandmother she's no longer is alive, but she's a fourth Cherokee. And she used to be in vaudeville, and she had wonderful clothes that she used to dress with feathers and big hats and vests and a lot of sparkly and colorful scarves and outfits. And really that's where Jimmy got his fashion sense. He thought that was a wonderful stage wear that she wore on stage. And she had a huge trunk, and when he was a kid he used to play in the trunk and put on the hats and the vests and the scarves, and so he brought that into and introduced it to his own wardrobe when he became the experience.
Isn't that incredible? Gosh, you know, someone, I noted somewhere that someone designed part of this outfit, but I can't recall their name. Do you?
I don't recall.
Yeah, I don't either. Is that outfit still around?
I believe it's at EMP, actually.
EMP?
Yes.
Where is that?
Oh, I'm sorry. In Seattle, Washington.
Seattle. Oh, yes, of course. I was thinking it would have been, I know there was some Hendrix stuff in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in there in Cleveland, I think. But I never saw this. So this is just gorgeous. And it wasn't just the outfit. He wore stones like turquoise, which happened to be one of the most spiritually potent stones you could possibly wear. Did he ever talk to you about these stones?
I didn't understand that it had healing aspect, although I do believe that it does. But being that it's once again part of the Indian culture and the sterling silver and the turquoise and jade and all that, he would love to wear that. Rings on his fingers he would wear to get different sounds on his guitar, believe it or not.
Oh, whoa. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it caused the strings to give off different sounds, depending on which fingers he was wearing his rings on. So that was why he liked her rings. And, of course, his bracelet, a lot of times he'd use his full arm to strum the strings. And so having the bracelet would also cause different sounds that he could create while he's playing.
Well, the healing power of turquoise is extraordinary. Native Americans have said time and again that they believe turquoise is more valuable than gold because it has the capacity, the ability, not just to heal, but if people are saying or doing negative things towards you, of which anyone who does anything in the act of creation these days especially, has to face, that energy is sent back to the person who sends it to you. So it's a mighty nice thing to have around. Now, he also did something that was most unusual. He began this trend of wearing a scarf around his knee. Did his grandma teach him that, too?
I don't think grandma taught him that. I think he learned that on his own. In fact, in the Royal Albert Hall film that we'll be coming out with next year, he takes a lot of care in putting the scarf right above his knee and ties it and doesn't quite get it right and unties it and reties it. So he did take a lot of time and energy and care to make sure that everything was just right, the knot was just right, and the ends of the scarves were hanging just right. It may seem, you know, haphazardly to some, but he was very, very meticulous.
Nothing seems haphazard about him when it comes to this. Because, you know, it takes a... I understand that before some of these events, before Jimmy came out and did any of this, nobody was wearing a scarf around the top of their knee. And yet, after Woodstock, there are a number of people that commented on this, that the vast majority of rock and roll musicians all of a sudden started wearing scarves all over the place, especially around their knee, and so did the audience. The audience walked out, tied things around the top of the knee, which I think is fantastic. There's something about that I'd like to mention, but I'm not going to get involved in that. He was a Sagittarian, friends, and there's something about Sagittarians and dealing with legs and arms that's really quite powerful. By the way, what were Jimmy's feelings about Woodstock afterwards?
Well, you know, he thought that it was a wonderful festival, and really he was in awe at how people had come out for those 3 days, and really almost 4 days, and they all lived amongst each other with peace and love and tranquility, and he was just so proud that in that day and time, how they could show everyone that that one could do that, you know, mm-hmm. because I don't think that people really believed it would be pulled off the way it was,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to close the show, and it was just an honor for him. It was something that he was glad he was at. I don't think that he ever realized how big of a historical event that he was at. I don't think any of us did at the time. Here it is 4 decades later, and we're still looking at it, examining it, talking about it. And some have relived it, you know, by doing the anniversary with Stocks. But it was just really an honor for him to play at it and be a part of it.
Are you going to be attending any of the Woodstock 40th anniversary events?
To tell you the truth, I haven't heard of any that have been coming up. We're really quite busy, you know, trying to get some of our new projects done. But I do plan to go out to the museum that they put up, and I'm not sure if I'll make it by the anniversary time. But I definitely will head out there.
Would you share with us the new things that are, you mentioned something that was going to be forthcoming from Hendrix in about a year?
Yeah, the Royal Albert Hall, and you know, it's kind of like reality TV as we know it today, where about 4 cameras followed Jimmy around and the band members for a month.
A month.
Found them in and out of the dressing rooms, in and out of apartments, hotel rooms, getting off of trains, planes, automobiles, and, of course, Royal Albert Hall concert, two of those, and various concerts through Europe. Especially in Germany. So we do plan to put that out next year.
Well, I really look forward to that. Unfortunately, we're out of time, Janie. This goes way too fast. Thank you for joining us, dear sister of Jimi Hendrix and the producer of the film Jimi Hendrix Live at Woodstock, jimihendrix.com. Next week, it's Old Time Radio. But right now, there's Jimi Hendrix.
Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore.
From ABC News, I'm Brad Wheatless.